the sheep and the goats. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "I tell you the truth. Whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me." Then he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me." They also will answer, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger or needing clothes, or sick or in prison, and did not help you?" He will reply, "I tell you the truth, whatever you did not do for one of these least of these, you did not do for me." Then they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteousness to eternal life.
Thanks, Eleanor. That was beautiful. You're a fantastic reader. Yeah. Well, tomorrow is a very significant day. I'm sure you're aware of that. Very special event happening tomorrow. All right? You have no idea, they say. Yes, the kilogram is being redefined. Isn't that amazing? The kilogram has been redefined. What do you mean the kilogram has been redefined? Yes, it's officially happening tomorrow. I was reading this during the week. So if you bake cakes, I don't think this is going to affect your flour measurements, whatever, you know, but the kilogram has been redefined. It says this in a magazine called the Scientific American, explains it like this. The official object that defines the mass of a kilogram is a tiny 139-year-old cylinder of platinum and iridium. That's that. It's a little tiny cylinder made of platinum and iridium. It's 139 years old, and it's kept in a triple-locked vault near Paris. Because it is so important, scientists almost never take it out. Instead, they use copies called working standards. But the last time they did inspect the real kilogram, they found it is roughly 5 parts in 100 million heavier than all the working standards, which they have been leaving behind a few items of metal every time they're put on the scales. So it's amazing when you think about it, isn't it? How do we know what a kilogram is? They decided this is a kilogram, this little small weight. It's very, very precious, kept at a proper temperature to make sure this is what a kilogram is. They keep it in a vault. They made 50 identical ones of these, sent them around the world so that everyone could know what a kilogram was. So a kilogram in Australia would be the same as a kilogram in Spain, would be the same as a kilogram in Dublin. These are the standards. But then they weighed that one day and they found it was microscopically smaller than the ones they've been using. 5 parts in 100 million. Tiny, isn't it? Does that really matter? So they've come up with a new way of defining it, of measuring it. It's not going to be measured by a physical object, but it's going to be measured by something else, which is too complicated for me to tell you. because I don't understand it. But I was reading about the standard for a meter. A meter length was a metal bar made of a particular metal at a particular temperature. It was held there, and this was the standard for 1 meter. But they changed that, and this is a bit more understandable, because instead of this physical thing, they define 1 meter as the distance that light goes in a particular time frame. I don't know what it is. It's very complicated. But if you imagine it, so that is a constant. It's not something you can put your finger on. It is one of the eternal truths of the universe, if we believe that the speed of light is a constant. So there's going to be, from tomorrow, they're going to measure it in a completely different way. But why change it? What's the point? What's all the fuss? Truth matters. That's the fuss. Truth matters. How we define these objects, these quantities, matters. Even if they vary by a minuscule amount, it matters. Truth matters. And these things are important to God. Back in Leviticus, he says this. You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah and a just hin, which are measurements of liquid and of solidy things, because I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Leviticus chapter 19. So it's a truth issue, but it's also a justice issue. Because you go to get your flour in the market, how do you know they're not ripping you off if the scales aren't right? If they're not measuring a kilo as it is meant to be? If they're robbing you of a few grains or giving someone else a few grains more? No, truth matters and justice matters. In life, we have started to redefine so many things. We have begun to redefine life, the meaning of life. So we talk about abortion and euthanasia. We redefine what it means to be human. Male, female, or can you be gender fluid? Where is the measurement? How do we know? Or we have begun to redefine relationships, especially a marriage relationship, which used to be a man and a woman, now it can be. How do you define it? Let's redefine it. So all around us, the world is changing, and it's changing fast. And even the vote that's coming up, that we'll be taking part in the divorce, and the amendment of the divorce legislation, is just another little chink in redefining relationships. Not as how God defines them, but as we choose to define them. And yet, truth matters. It is a justice issue. And yet, everywhere we see injustice, everywhere we see untruth, everywhere we see corruption, there are financial scams. We know the banks got the world into big trouble. There was the LIBOR scandal, which was the banks fiddling interest rates for their own benefit. Or do you remember back, beginning in 2015, there was the Volkswagen emission scandal? Do you remember that? Where Volkswagen placed a little bit of software into their engines, so whenever they did an emission test for diesel engines, it lied. Because the fact was that those engines were 40 times more toxic than they were saying. So Volkswagen were saying these are clean diesels, but really they were not clean diesels. Truth matters. It is a justice issue. There is an index called the Corruption Perception Index. Got a map of that. Bet you didn't even know there was such a thing, did you? A corruption index. And it's put together, this is about perceived levels of public sector corruption. The ones that are dark, red, almost black, are the most corrupt places in the world. The least corrupt places are like the light blue, like Australia and North America. The least corrupt place, according to this measurement, is places like Denmark and New Zealand and Finland. The UK comes 11th on the corruption index. Ireland comes 18th. The worst places, down at 150, are Somalia, Sudan, North Korea, Iraq. Corruption is everywhere. And yet, truth matters. It's a justice issue. And yet all around, political life, business life, we see greed, we see the misuse of power. We live in a really messed up world. Nations at war, millions exterminated. I was reading about some of the awful dictators, well, from the 20th century. I'm going to show you some pictures. Anybody recognize who that is? That lovely, smiling chap? Sorry? Pol Pot. Yeah. He looks so innocent, really, doesn't he? Harmless. Probably teach Sunday school somewhere. And yet he was responsible for the death of up to 2.5 million people in Cambodia. You'll recognize the next chap. He's much more recent. Saddam Hussein in Iraq. He's responsible for 2 million deaths also. Here's another one you might not recognize. Recognize him from Japan. Hirohito. You're very good. You're top of the class here. This is great. Yeah, he's responsible for 6 million deaths. This guy. Here's another one you'll definitely know. We know, of course, about the 6 million Jews that he exterminated, but up to 20 million people died under his leadership. Another one you'll know as well. Who was it? It was Greek. Stalin. USSR. He's responsible for the deaths of somewhere between 40 and 62 million people. These huge numbers. Up to 62 million people. And finally, Craig, who's this? Mao. Mao Zedong. Well, he wins this little competition because he's responsible for the death of somewhere between 45 and 75 million people. As well as killing, these leaders also put into place repressive measures against people who didn't agree with them. Wiped out the rights and freedoms of the citizen. Anyone who stood against them, it's not good. These were not my nice people. And yet I was reading, these are only a selection. There's loads of people I've never heard of responsible for millions and millions of deaths. We live in a really messed up world. And each one of these leaders is just like the leader of Babylon, Belshazzar. Remember that wonderful story in Daniel 5, where the finger came and wrote on the wall. And do you remember what it said? You've been weighed in the balance and found wanting. And yet it's not just national dictators who are the bullies, but in our day-to-day lives we face bullies, whether it's a school or in a workplace or in a neighborhood. There are bullies everywhere. And everything within us cries out for justice. This is not right. This is not fair. And yet what can we do about it? But something within aches and says, someone do something. Everything within us cries justice. Back in Genesis chapter 4, we read about the first murder. The sons of Adam, Cain, Abel. And the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? I don't know, he said. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, what have you done? Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. What a great line. Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. There's something within all of us that recognizes evil. And we cry out for justice. Whether it's the young person who's the victim of cyberbullying, they cry out for justice. Or the young woman who has been violently raped cries out for justice. Or the man whose reputation has been unfairly trashed cries out for justice. It's not fair. And the psalmist did exactly the same thing. If you read the Psalms at all, you won't need to read many to find the psalmist saying, Lord, look at the state of this world. It's a mess. These people who don't love you, don't love anybody, they seem to do pretty well. They're evil, they're corrupt, but they're healthy. They're wealthy. They've got everything. And there's something within the psalmist that says, this is not right. This is not fair. And yet, there are always consequences. For Adam and Eve back in the Garden of Eden, when they were given the free rein, wow, what a relationship they had. Don't eat the fruit of that tree, because if you do, you shall die. And they ate. The consequence was that they were put out of the garden, no longer having access to God, no longer having access to the tree of life. The consequence is that what God says, God means, and they were put outside, not to return. Consequences. There's always a day of reckoning. We can spend, but when the bills come in, what are we going to do? The day of reckoning will come. Psalm 11. The Lord examines the righteous, but the wicked and those who love violence, his soul hates. On the wicked he will rain fiery coals and burning sulfur. A scorching wind will be their lot. But it's easy to look around. We can see a corrupt world. We can see a world that is really, really messy. And something within us does cry, that's not fair. We want justice. And yet it's easy to look out, but it's so hard to look in. John Stott, a writer, says this. He points out that we tend to be far quicker in making judgments of others than ourselves. He says this, we work ourselves up into a state of self-righteous indignation over the disgraceful behavior of other people, while the very behavior seems not so nearly so serious when it is ours rather than theirs. So it's easy to get mad looking out, but it's easy to overlook when we look inward, and yet the truth is that we are all deficient. If we are weighed in the balances, we will all be found wanting. We are all like sheep who have gone astray. We all would rather choose darkness rather than light. None of us can rise above our condition. Psalm 14. The Lord looks down from heaven on the children of man, to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is none who does good, not even one. And you thought you were the one, and I thought I was the one, but we're both wrong. Not even one. And yet God is not unmoved. God does not stand on a distance and doesn't care. He sees all things and he cares, for he is holy. He cannot let corruption reign. He cannot let injustice have its way. He is a fair God, a perfect God. Truth matters, and he is the righteous judge of all things, of all people. We acknowledge that truth every time we say the Apostles' Creed, which says this. We've been working our way through it after a fashion. He was crucified, died, and was buried. He descended into hell. On the third day he rose again and ascended into heaven. Remember, we thought about that last week. And he is seated at the right hand of the Father, and he will come to judge the living and the dead. A day is coming when God will judge all of us, because truth matters, because justice matters. Paul told the Athenians that God has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man that he has appointed, and he has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. That's a sobering fact, isn't it? It tells us that there will be an end to history, and we will all become accountable. And we are accountable to Jesus, the one who died and rose again, the perfect judge. And we shall answer for everything we've done. Everything we've done. every careless word, every thoughtless thought, every action, everything, for he knows all. The Psalms tell us that God is a righteous judge, and that should make the wicked tremble. Why should the fact that God is good make us tremble? Well, can you imagine a mafia boss who's been arrested and he's going for trial and he swaggers into the courtroom without a care in the world? Why is that? Well, he knows that the judge is corrupt. He knows that the judge has been paid off. He knows that the judge has been threatened and his family have been threatened. So he walks into the care room, into the courtroom without a care in the world, because the judge is corrupt. But what about if you come into a courtroom and the judge cannot be intimidated, cannot be bribed, where the judge is perfect? That's a kind of scary thought, is it not? In the sermon that Jesus gave on the Mount of Olives in the middle of his last week in Jerusalem, he used three parables to teach about the final judgment and what it would be like. We had a reading from the third one. The first one is the parable of the 10 young women who had been invited to the wedding banquet. Invited to the wedding banquet, 5 of them were wise. They went off and bought oil for their lamps in preparation. The others didn't. They took it easy. They fell asleep. They thought they could do it some other time. But suddenly someone shouted, "The bridegroom's coming! Get ready to welcome him!" And the 5 who hadn't bought the oil said, "Wow, we better run to the shops and get our oil," and off they went. But on the way back, they were too late. The bridegroom had already come, and the door was shut. And they came up to the door and knocked, and they said, "Let us in." But the voice inside said, "Too late. I've no idea who you are." At Hosek's concert the other night, Sharon was coming in. "Why did you mention that?" she's saying. "What? Why do you mention my name?" "Because Sharon was a bit late." But she wasn't too late, because we'd all been told, as soon as it starts, the doors are closed and no one gets in. You got in, Sharon. We all get in. But it's the same kind of idea, that idea of there's a time when it's too late. The second parable is the one that we know really well, the parable of the talents, where the master has gone off on a journey and he calls his 3 servants. To the one he gives 5 talents, to another he gives 2, and the third one he gives 1, all according to their ability, and off he goes. And when he returns from the journey, he calls the servants to him and he said, "Well, let's see what you did with what I gave you." And the one with the 5 talents, he had invested it and gained 5 more, so he had 10. He handed it to his master to look, and the master said, "That's brilliant." The second one, who had been given 2, he had invested it and got 2 more, so he brought 4 talents and said, "Here's the 4, and his master said, "This is brilliant." But the last one, the one with 1, he said, "Here's your 1 back again." And the master said, "I don't understand. What have you done?" And he said, "I knew you were hard. I was scared of you, so I buried the talent. And then I brought it out of the ground again because I knew you're a hard man and I didn't want to lose it." And the master said, "You are wicked." And he cast him out to utter darkness, where there's weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. What do we do with what we have been given? We have been given so much. You have a Bible in front of you, God's Word. We have the Spirit. We have prayer. We have so much. When we stand on that day of judgment and he says, "Well, what did you do with what I gave you?" What are we going to say? The final one, the one that Eleanor read, it's about the sheep and the goats. And Jesus said this, "When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. And then the king will say to those on his right, 'Come, you who are blessed by my Father, Take your inheritance. What is the inheritance? The inheritance is the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. What an inheritance. The kingdom for the sheep. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. Judgment. Blessings. Curses. Now how can this be? How can some be on one side and some on the other if it is true that we are all corrupt? If, as the psalm says, there is no one righteous, not even one, how can there be some who are blessed and some who are cursed? Well, we thought about that a few weeks ago, didn't we, when we thought about heaven? We thought about those who had washed their robes in the blood of the Lamb, made them white in the blood of the Lamb. They're the blessed ones. Not their own righteousness, not their own good deeds, nothing of themselves, no merit of my own I bring. Simply to the cross I cling. This is those who have clothed themselves with Jesus. As John Stott says, we cannot possibly stand before God's dazzling white throne in the soiled and tattered rags of our own morality, but only if we have sought cleansing from the Lamb who died for us. In God's courtroom, for those of us who are followers of Jesus, we have an advocate. We do not stand there on our own. For if we did, the righteous judge would cast us all away. But for those who have faith, we stand with Jesus. And yet, as Hebrews says, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? God is a God of love. We might think of God as a God of love. How can he do that? But love demands justice. What would it be like if all of these people got away with all of these things? Where is the justice? We know justice is right, and so judgment must take place. And yet here is love, vast as the ocean, loving kindness from above. When the Prince of Heaven, our ransom, shed his blood, I can't remember how it goes, but this is love. That God loved us so much that he made it possible for us to come back to him. Heaven's peace and perfect justice kissed a guilty world in love. So on that day, which is coming, and it will be a public meeting, and we will stand there, and we will have to give an account of who we are and what we've done, what we've known. What are we going to say? What are we going to do? Will we have Jesus on our side? And will we be gathered with the sheep here and know God's blessing? Inherit God's kingdom? Or shall we have left it too late? Will we have dismissed Jesus? Will we thought there is no judgment? I can redefine anything I want in the way that I want to, and there are no consequences. We will be wrong. It's not meant to be scary, but it's meant to be real, because that is what we look for. We're looking for fairness. We're looking for judgment. We're looking to Jesus.